Hello and welcome to Science Weekly. I'm Ian Sample. On this week's show, emotions and irrationality. No, we're not talking about the Science Weekly program meeting. We talk to the author of a new book that explains how we make decisions. Cosmic inflation might sound like something the Chancellor of the Exchequer should be dealing with, but Professor Alan Guth explains how it actually means the universe is still expanding.
Experiments with plutonium, uranium, and polonium. Prisoners, a captive research population. Secrecy, human radiation experiments, and intentional releases. And some of these experiments involved feeding radioactive oatmeal to retarded children in institutions. I mean, it's just actually not a very pretty episode.
Olivia Judson joined us last week to talk about the importance of daring experiments. This week we have highlights from her recent lecture. And there's news of a surprising find of bomb-grade plutonium, how leading figures in industry are denying the existence of climate change, and how the east of England is the most godless part of Britain. It's all in this edition of Science Weekly from The Guardian. Your usual master of ceremonies, Alok Jha, has gone to India for a few weeks, and foolishly he's left proceedings up to me. But fear not. Here in the studio to help us make sense of recent developments in science are The Guardian's James Randerson and a legend from the Nature News team, Jeff Brumfield. Men, welcome aboard.
Well, hi there, Ian.
But our guest today is Jonah Lehrer. Jonah has worked in the lab of a Nobel Prize-winning neuroscientist, was a Rhodes Scholar at Oxford, and is now an editor-at-large for Seed magazine. He's here to talk about his new book, The Decisive Moment, which tells us not only how our brains make decisions, but how we can learn to make better ones in the future. Jonah, thanks for coming in. What made you decide to write the book?
It was really my own decision-making failures. It was the fact that I would spend half an hour trying to choose between breakfast cereals in the morning, and you know, walking through the toothpaste aisle in the supermarket would give me panic attacks. So it was trying to figure out, number one, how I should be thinking in the supermarket and what was happening inside my head in the first place.
You use the story of Michael Reilly in your book, who was on a British warship in the Gulf War, to make a point about trusting our gut feelings. What happened there?
This was the second day of the ground invasion of the first Persian Gulf War, and Michael Reilly was in the radar room of the HMS Gloucester, and his job was to watch out for Silkworm missiles. These are massive Iraqi missiles that the Allies were afraid would be launched at their convoy in the Persian Gulf. This was a fleet of American battleships, destroyers, and two aircraft carriers. And so at 5:01 in the morning, pre-dawn hours, Michael Reilly sees these two neon green blips on his radar screen. And as soon as he sees these blips, he's seized by this very powerful emotion of fear. He's convinced these blips are Iraqi Silkworm missiles, and then if he does nothing, they're going to sink an American battleship. The problem is that these blips are traveling the exact same path that American A-6 fighter jets have been traveling for the past 6 weeks. So what should he do? Should he fire his Sea Dart missiles? These are his sea-to-air missiles. But he rationally knows that he might also shoot down an A-6 fighter jet. He eventually decides to trust this very intense feeling of fear, fires the Sea Darts, and then has to wait for several hours to figure out what it was he shot down. It eventually turns out that he was a hero. And several years later, it wasn't until a cognitive psychologist investigated the situation and found that there really was a subtle discrepancy in the timing of the blips. The blips appeared off the coast at 3 seconds difference. And it was that difference, Gary Klein argued, that actually led Michael Reilly to experience this feeling of fear and then give the order to fire.
But what's really interesting about that is that Michael Reilly himself wasn't sure why he had done it.
Oh, absolutely. He couldn't begin to explain it. This level of analysis is taking place below the surface of self-awareness. So you have no idea what your emotional brain may be responding to, what these dopamine neurons may actually be responding to in the real world.
No, I was loving your book until the third chapter because I thought that all I needed to do was like trust my instincts when I came across a tough decision. But in the rest of the book, you go on to explain how it's not that simple and there are times when we should be ignoring our gut feelings.
Absolutely. You know, I think the emotional brain is an astonishing tool. It's got tremendous processing power, and yet it's also full of these hardwired flaws. Things like loss aversion, for instance. This is an emotional flaw first diagnosed by Daniel Kahneman and Amos Tversky back in the late 70s. And loss aversion is a very simple idea. It's that people are irrationally sensitive to losses. So I think one way this plays out in everyday life is when people evaluate their stock portfolios. And it turns out that when people decide which stocks to buy or sell, they're most likely to sell stocks that have gone up in value, those, you know, rare stocks right now. And that's because they don't want to take the loss. They don't want to make the loss tangible. They want to postpone the loss for as long as possible. Unfortunately, that means you end up with a stock portfolio composed entirely of losing stocks, of stocks that are going down in value, which is why, as Terry Odian and UC Berkeley has found, the stocks people sell outperform the stocks they keep by about 3.5%, which is a pretty significant percentage.
Yeah. You talk in the book also about some people who cannot make decisions, who literally cannot make decisions. And can you just say a bit about how that comes about and what effect it has?
One of the most powerful pieces of evidence that we're not quite as rational as we'd like to believe comes from the work of a neurologist named Antonio Damasio, who began in the early 80s studying patients who, because of a brain tumor in their frontal lobes, lost the ability to experience emotion. So all these subtle feelings of pleasure and pain that we take for granted, they couldn't experience. And you'd think if you were Plato that these people would become philosopher kings, that they would make the best set of decisions possible. Instead, what you find is they become pathologically indecisive, that they'll spend all day trying to figure out where to eat lunch. So in this sense, pure reason isn't something to aspire to. Pure reason's actually a disease.
James, you've got a question?
Yeah, I just wanted to bring you back to loss aversion. I mean, that's a very good example of something that is apparently sort of maladaptive, but presumably has, had served some kind of purpose. Are there any ideas out there about why that might have evolved?
Absolutely. I mean, I think back in the Pleistocene era, it may have been very good to be loss averse. And the fact is, we're not just loss averse when it comes to stocks. I think there are lots of studies across various domains that people take criticisms and losses much more harshly than gains and nice things. So, for example, psychologists have shown that in order to make up for one harsh criticism you've said to someone, you have to say about five nice things. It's tough to know how accurate those theories are, but I think one way to look at financial bubbles is that people lose that fear of loss. People are convinced that the stock market will keep on going up and up and up, so they don't think about, well, maybe the Royal Bank of Scotland isn't the soundest bank in the world. So they stop thinking about losses, and the end result is a reckless financial bubble. So clearly, loss aversion isn't just a bad thing. I think in different contexts, it can be very, very useful. I think that's the general truism of the brain in general. You can see how the dopamine system can help us see patterns in the real world and can be an incredibly useful tool of cognition. But put that in a different context, and dopamine makes you a crack addict and addicted to slot machines.
So very broadly, I think it'll have to be very broad. What is going on in our brains when we face a decision? We have to come down one side or another or choose from a multiple of options.
There's very rarely just one brain area active whenever you make a decision. So, for instance, there's work done by Brian Knutson at Stanford and George Lowenstein at Carnegie Mellon where they put undergraduates in a fMRI machine and had them make everyday shopping decisions. So they gave them stuff like the latest Harry Potter book, the George Foreman grill. And what they saw was that when you show people the item, and if it was an item they wanted, a brain area called the nucleus accumbens was turned on. This is a brain area associated with feelings of pleasure and reward. It releases dopamine. And so people said, oh, I really want the George Foreman grill. At the same time, when you show people the price tag, a brain area called the insula is turned on. The insula is associated with feelings of bodily pain and disgust and, negative aversive feelings. It turns out it's also turned on by having to pay for something. So there really is this kind of argument taking place. One interesting side note of this experiment is that when people pay with a credit card, the insula is less active than normal. Right. That because the transaction's abstract, because you're not taking cash out of your wallet, you're just swiping this plastic thing, your insula doesn't quite understand what's going on, so it's less sensitive to the pain of having to pay for it. So I think that begins to explain why people spend too much on their credit cards. But I think I often use that experiment when I'm thinking about decision making, just in the sense I think it does capture the kind of general gestalt of what's happening when we make decisions. That different brain areas are always activated by different things in the real world. The question is how to reconcile this argument taking place inside your head.
But how can we in the sort of the real world learn to make better decisions?
I think it does come through something called metacognition, which is thinking about thinking. And I think one great example of how metacognition can improve how we think comes from the work of Walter Mischel. He's a psychologist now at Columbia. He's probably best known for a study of the marshmallow task, which was back in between 1968 and 1972. He'd bring four-year-olds into his lab and make them an offer. He'd say, you can have one marshmallow right now, or if you wait, you can have a second marshmallow. Needless to say, just about all the kids wanted to wait for the second marshmallow. But what he found was that there's this tremendous variation in terms of how long some kids could wait. That some kids could wait 30 seconds. Some kids would pop the marshmallow in their mouth before he left. Some kids could wait the full 20 minutes. And so then he became interested in, well, what allowed some kids to wait longer than others? And what he found was that some kids better understood how their mind works. Some kids knew that willpower was weak. And so what they had to do was distract themselves. So they would go stand in the corner, or they would, go pull their hair or turn their back or pretend the marshmallow was a cloud. Mischel later found that when he studied these kids, these four-year-olds as high school students, that the kids who could wait for a marshmallow at four-year-olds had higher SAT scores, they had higher GPAs, grade point average, they were far less likely to do drugs, they had better control of their tempers. So as he puts it, this is by far the most predictive test you can give a four-year-old, far more predictive than the IQ test. He's also shown in the years since that if you take low-performing kids in the Bronx, for instance, it's a poor neighborhood in New York City, kids who can't wait 30 seconds for a marshmallow, and you simply tell them some of these tricks. You simply say, why don't you pretend the marshmallow's a cloud? Draw a picture frame around the marshmallow so the hot stimulus isn't quite so hot. All of a sudden, these kids who couldn't wait 30 seconds can now wait 10, 15, 20 minutes. So I think that's a very clear example of how simply learning these very simple rules, having a slightly better understanding of how your mind works and how you can delay gratification, can really lead to improvements in decision making.
Okay, well, stay with us for the rest of the program, Jonah, but for now, thanks. Jonah's book, The Decisive Moment, How the Brain Makes Up Its Mind, is out now, and you can get it at guardian.co.uk/bookshop. Now for some of this week's news from the world of science, here's James and Jeff with the News Jam.
News Jam. Senior figures in the manufacturing industry do not accept that global warming is happening or that action needs to be taken to prepare for it, according to the UK government's science minister. Lord Drayson said recent discussions with leaders in the car industry and other businesses had left him shocked at the number of climate change deniers among leading industrialists. Of those who acknowledged that global temperatures were rising, many blamed it on variations in the sun's activity.
A glass bottle unearthed at a disused waste burial ground in the US has been found to contain one of the world's oldest samples of bomb-grade plutonium. The one-gallon vessel was discovered in 2004 during a cleanup operation at a waste trench at the Hanford nuclear site in Washington State. The cleanup team noticed the bottle contained a mysterious white slurry and sent it for testing. Scientists at the Pacific Northwest National Laboratory in Richland have now revealed that the drug contained several hundred milligrams of bomb-grade plutonium, which they dated to 1944, when the Manhattan Project was still in its infancy.
The east of England may be the most godless region of the UK, according to a belief map published by a theology think tank. Almost half of adults there believe the theory of evolution makes God obsolete, and more than 80% disagree with creationism and intelligent design, which propose that humans were created by God in the past 10,000 years, and that life owes its complexity to divine intervention. The map was drawn up by the think tank Theos following a survey of more than 2,000 people across the country who were chosen to be representative of the adult population.
And at the time of this recording, NASA's Kepler mission, the first to look for habitable Earth-sized planets, was only hours away from liftoff at Cape Canaveral in Florida. The one-ton spacecraft will spend 3.5 years gazing at 100,000 stars in the Milky Way in the hope of spotting other Earths as they pass in front of the stars. The mission will pinpoint planets in the Goldilocks region of space where conditions are just right for liquid water to exist. As one NASA scientist put it, this is not about finding ET, but finding ET's home.
Let's have a closer look at a couple of those stories. James, Lord Drayson, our science minister, says top-level industrialists are still in denial about climate change. It's like being back in the 90s, isn't it?
I know, it's bizarre, isn't it? I mean, particularly the fact that that old canard, the sunspot explanation, is being kind of wheeled out. It just shows how kind of successful, I think, what I've heard referred to as the denialosphere has been, this sort of lobbying effort. I mean, it's quite depressing.
You don't like the phrase climate change denier, do you? I know I used it in my report, and it's obviously in quite widespread use.
Absolutely.
But it's not one of your favourites.
I'm not keen on it, and I wrote a blog on this last week, actually. The reason I'm not keen on it is that I think it allows those on the other side of the debate to make the argument that we are trying to portray them in the same light as Holocaust deniers. And I think that because Holocaust denial is such a kind of phrase in common parlance to sort of, I don't know, it, people make the link that's what people like George Monbiot are trying to do, which they're not. I mean, George is keen on the phrase climate change denial because he says, it's the best way to describe what they're doing. They're just denying facts which are, should be accepted by everyone. He then kind of challenged me to come up with something different, and it is difficult because calling people a climate change skeptic, that doesn't quite work, because when you really think about what skeptic means, it's kind of a searcher for truth, and I actually don't believe that many of them are doing that. I think they're deliberately twisting the evidence in many cases and cherry picking data to kind of obfuscate. But so my solution solution is to call them climate change creationists. Because
Are you serious?
I am absolutely serious, yeah, because when you think about it, they argue in a very similar way. I believe that, I'm really talking about kind of the professionals here, if you know what I mean, the sort of Christopher Bookers of this world, who have a fixed opinion, and they want to fit the data to that, and that's exactly what creationists do.
So legal letters coming in from Christopher Booker, no doubt, very soon. I saw George's defence of that, and he was saying that he thought your idea of using the term climate change creationist was confusing. And I've got to say I have some sympathy with that idea, but I wasn't very aware that many climate change deniers were saying that to the scientists, you're trying to brand us in the same sort of vein as Holocaust deniers. But anyway, moving on. Jeff, Kepler, a great mission for NASA. Are you excited about this, or is it just another planet hunter?
Well, just another planet hunter. I mean, Ian, you sound so jaded. Just another planet hunter. There's actually only one other satellite up there right now looking for this stuff. It's Corot. It's a French satellite, and Kepler's going to be a big improvement over that. It's going to be able to spot Earth-sized planets, and it's going to be looking at a large number of stars. So hopefully it will see something during its multi-year mission.
Is it? It sounds to me as if it's going to be looking at this really star-rich area of the Milky Way for 3.5 years. I mean, will we actually get any information from it within those 3.5 years, or do we have to watch for 3.5 years and then look at the data afterwards?
It depends what you're looking for. If you're looking for something just like Earth, what the satellite does is it looks for tiny eclipses of the star. So if it was Earth, we'd have to see 3 eclipses, basically, before we could confirm it. So it'd take all 3 years. But there's going to be other kinds of planets that will be orbiting more quickly or at different distances, and they'll be different sizes. So it will see things before the end of its mission.
It won't actually be able to tell us whether there's life on any of these, though, right? It'll just tell us whether they are places which look nice targets.
That's right. That's right. It's not going to be powerful enough to actually discern whether there's an atmosphere, whether there's signs of life. And, you know, the future missions that can do that are still on the drawing board and are going to require some very advanced technology.
Are you getting a feel from the kind of interviews you're doing with people over in the States at the moment, or even over here, about how NASA's going to fare under Obama?
To be honest with you, I think there's a big question mark there. Obama hasn't named a NASA administrator yet, and NASA's facing some pretty serious challenges. It's retiring the shuttle in 2010, although there's been some talk of extending that, and the follow-on system, which is called Orion, really is not quite there yet.
Obama just doesn't seem that keen on space, really. I mean, in the campaign, he didn't seem like he wanted to spend loads of money, carrying on the sort of Bush plans, to kind of carry on to the moon and then Mars and things like that. Is he really an enthusiast in any way? Has he got enough cash to do anything?
I think really the issue there is, the Bush plans were, even at the time, seemed pretty starry-eyed. I mean, how to get to the moon and to Mars on existing budgets with a system like the shuttle that you're trying to run is pretty difficult. So even as it was announced, I remember there being a fair bit of skepticism that it could ever actually be achieved. And I think we'll just have to see what happens.
Let's draw a line under that there. You can keep up with all the week's science stories on our site, guardian.co.uk/science. It is said that there is no such thing as a free lunch, but the universe is the ultimate free lunch. So said Alan Guth, the MIT professor of physics, who came up with the idea of cosmic inflation in the 1980s. According to Guth's theory, the early universe went through an initial phase of exponential expansion before condensing into the universe we see today. I caught up with Guth at the recent AAAS conference in Chicago and asked him to take me through it all.
Inflation actually offers the possibility of producing a universe from essentially nothing. An inflationary model, the amount of matter that's needed to start the universe is something on the order of a gram, and all of the rest is actually produced during inflation itself. So you get a whole universe essentially for free, and in fact now we're even talking about inflation becoming eternal. Almost all models of inflation, it turns out, produce not just one universe, but an infinite number of universes, all for the price of one, which was essentially free to begin with. Inflation is not a theory of the ultimate origin of the universe. The 1 gram is small enough so that it could just be a quantum fluctuation starting from absolutely nothing. And there's speculation about that. But it's I think still going to be a long time before we have a real theory of the ultimate origin of the universe. Dark energy has an interesting relationship to inflation. In some ways, it helped to confirm inflation, because one of the problems that inflationary models had 10 years ago was that inflation makes a prediction for the mass density of the universe. And the value that inflation predicts 10 years ago looked like it was too high. The actual mass density 10 years ago looked like it was only about a fifth or maybe a third of what inflation predicts. Then came along dark energy, and when you add in the dark energy, it adds up just right, so that now the total mass density that's observed for the universe, including the dark energy, is really exactly to within a percent or so is how accurately they can measure it. So to within the percent or so of the uncertainties of the measurements, it's exactly right for what inflation predicts. So in that sense, dark energy was good news for inflation. On the other hand, we don't know what dark energy is. The big problem in understanding dark energy is in understanding the magnitude of it. And the real question is, why is the magnitude so incredibly small? By all the standards of particle physics, it's just a ridiculously small number. And that means that no combination of physical constants that you might put together is going to give you anything that's even a potential calculation for what this dark energy is. The dark energy behaves like it's vacuum energy. And we have our estimates of what we think the vacuum energy ought to be from first principles. And those rough estimates are like 120 orders of magnitude larger than the actual value of the energy density of the dark energy. And it's figuring out where that factor of 10 to the minus 120 comes from is the big mystery in trying to understand what dark energy actually is. Perhaps it needs to be that small for any kind of life to exist. It certainly does have to be this small for life like us to exist, or approximately this small. Life like us requires the formation of galaxies, and this vacuum energy has the effect of causing the expansion of the universe to accelerate. So if you have too much of it, the universe is just blown apart before galaxies could form and before life like us could exist. Conversely, one could imagine a negative vacuum energy. It doesn't have to be positive. And if it were negative, it would cause the universe to recollapse rapidly, and again, life would not form. So life like us clearly does require a vacuum energy density that's within maybe a factor of five or so of what we observe, not this factor of 10 to the 120. There's no one observation that will clear things up. It would, of course, be nice to know if this really is vacuum energy or not. So far, all of the measurements are consistent with vacuum energy. One problem with trying to pin that down is that vacuum energy is pretty devoid of detailed complications. Vacuum energy is characterized by the fact that the pressure has a particular value related to the energy density and constant. So in terms of observations, you can show by making better and better observations that the stuff that's out there is close in its behavior to the way vacuum energy would behave. And you can make better and better measurements and show that's closer and closer. But it's hard to know when you're going to draw the line and say, well, that means that it really is vacuum energy. There's always a possibility that something else that just acts a lot like vacuum energy.
That was Alan Guth. Jeff, is cosmic inflation generally accepted as true?
I mean, I don't know. It would kind of depend who you were asking. I think the average person on the street probably wouldn't have much of an opinion about it. But certainly cosmologists think it's true. There's a number of reasons, two primarily. One is that for the universe to be as lumpy as it is, for matter to be distributed as evenly as it is, you really need a period of very rapid growth right after the Big Bang. And inflation is a great tool for creating that. But then inflation also sort of predicted the existence of this dark energy that Guth was talking about, this force that seems to be pushing everything apart.
And so is the universe going to keep expanding forever? I mean, or is it, are we headed for a big crunch? Do we know the answer to that yet?
Well, at the moment, the answer is it's going to expand forever. And not only that, but it's a little more distressing. It's going to expand faster and faster. And as it does, as things get more spread out, it's all going to die. You know, stars are going to fade away. planets are just going to sort of end up spread apart, and there's just not going to be much out there, really. But, you know, don't get too distressed. It's many, many billion years in coming.
So we're around at a pretty good time, then, in terms of what we can see.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And this is something that bothers cosmologists. They call it the cosmic coincidence problem. Sort of, why is everything exactly the way it is? Why are we in existence and in exactly the time when we're supposed to be able to see all this stuff? And it really bugs them, because they would like a system where everything was just the same all the time and we could exist or not exist, but it doesn't work that way.
You're getting dangerously spiritual on me.
Oh, I know. It always happens with this stuff.
We heard Guth there saying that if inflation's right, there must be other universes. But if that's true, why can't we see them?
there's a really easy and kind of inane answer to this question, and that is the universe is by definition everything we can see. So if there's another universe, we can't see it almost by definition, because if we could, it'd be part of our own. Another way, if that's too like loopy for you, I guess... The other way of thinking about it is that, you know, light only travels with a finite speed, and so we can only see so many billion years back into the universe, but that also means that we can only see so far away, because there's things out there where the light has not reached us yet. And so these parts of, I don't know if you call it our universe or another universe, but they'd be causally disconnected from our own.
It's good to see you wrestling with that, Jeff. Thanks. Thanks very much.
Yeah, especially after karaoke. Yeah.
On last week's show, the biologist and author Olivia Judson argued that scientists need to take more risks with their experiments. In a lecture last week, she expanded on those thoughts and discussed the ethics of experimentation in more detail by highlighting two examples.
I now want to look at something else which I think rightly inhibits some of the experiments we do, which is ethics. And I want to talk about two American examples. The first is the Tuskegee syphilis experiment, which was begun in 1932, finished in 1972. It wasn't really an experiment, it was an observation. I went and looked up one of the papers from it, which was published in the Archives of Internal Medicine in 1964. The year 1963 marks the 30th year of the long-term evaluation of the effect of untreated syphilis in the male Negro, conducted by the Venereal Disease Branch Communicable Disease Center of the United States Public Health Service. So this study was basically, you take guys who've got syphilis, you tell them you're giving them medical treatment, and you don't treat them. They remarked that the syphilitic group continues to have higher mortality. In 1932, the main treatment for syphilis was mercury, as indeed the 19th century French writer Maupassant once remarked, you spend one night with Venus and the rest of your life with mercury. But in 1943, penicillin was discovered. Penicillin treated syphilis. It still treats syphilis, actually. It hasn't developed any antibiotic resistance. And so by 1964, these men could have been treated. And indeed, by 1972, they certainly could have been. And so there are ethical problems sometimes in science. I also, for reasons that I can no longer remember, I'm in possession of this, rather sort of telephone book size, the final report of the Advisory Committee on Human Radiation Experiments, which was also done by the United States, also after the war. And I just want to give a couple of examples from the table of contents. Experiments with plutonium, uranium, and polonium. Non-therapeutic research on children. Prisoners, a captive research population. Secrecy, human radiation experiments, and intentional releases. These experiments, some of which aren't quite as bad as they sound when you read the table of contents, because it turns out that it was actually all very, very small doses of radiation, but not all of them. And some of these experiments involved feeding radioactive oatmeal to retarded children in institutions. I mean, it's just actually not a very pretty episode. And I bring these up because, although we all know that there were horrors in the Nazi concentration camps and that the Japanese did appalling things on Chinese prisoners of war, this is much more recent. And, you know, it does highlight some problems with the undertaking, but also some questions that we can't easily answer. And so, for example, although some people would like to do human-chimpanzee crosses, it strikes me as off the table. And last week or 2 weeks ago, when Savanti Pavo announced the sequencing of the Neanderthal genome, an American scientist called George Church said, well, give me $30 million and I'll bring them back. However, this does raise quite serious problems because questions of ethics or morality mean that there are some areas about which we would like to know that we don't really know very much. For example, human sex. There are a lot of questions, basic questions about human sex that we just don't know the answer to. One of them is, in many mammals, ovulation is induced by sexual activity. In humans, obviously, it doesn't need to be always, which is to say many females will ovulate anyway. However, not every menstrual cycle is an ovulatory cycle. And I think that it would be very interesting to know whether ovulation can be induced and whether, in fact, as in some other animals, it is induced by multiple partners or not. Now, obviously, these are questions that we're probably not going to know the answer to, but they're interesting.
Olivia Judson there, giving this year's Sense About Science lecture in London. James, is this an age gone by, or are unethical experiments still with us?
Before I come to that, I just wanted to make a couple of points about the syphilis experiment that sort of struck me listening to that again. I mean, one is it feels like it's no accident that those were done at the time on as they call it, male Negroes. I mean, one wonders that they were, they're because of different attitudes at the time, that can't be an accident. The question of whether treatments work, I mean, there are some treatments which in the past were doing more harm than good, like, in a bygone age, doing bloodletting, for example. And so, there is a legitimate question there in terms of, how do we work out whether treatments work or not? But equally, there have to be kind of ethical roadblocks that say, okay, this knowledge might be desirable, but there are certain circumstances under which, you're just not allowed to find it out, if you see what I mean. But in terms of, are we in a better age? Well, she made a point later on in response to one of the questions regarding experiments on animals and particularly on primates, and she hazarded an opinion that later generations might look back on our age as a rather barbaric age for doing those kind of experiments.
Jonah, how does this strike you? Do you think we're sort of out of this period of doing these sort of obviously unethical experiments, or are we just too blind to see what we're doing?
Well, I think the question of ethics and animal research, especially as it pertains to primates, is a fascinating question for modern science, and it's a very, very complicated question. I don't think there are simple answers. I think what we're learning now about the brain has taught us that when you keep primates in what are called standard lab enclosures, so those terribly small, kind of metal, stainless steel cages, you find that their brain is actually warped, that these enclosures are so stressful, they induce so much anxiety, they induce chronic stress, that these primates have reduced neurogenesis, they have reduced synaptic plasticity, their brains are literally not normal, they're deformed. So I think we now know enough to know that the standard lab enclosures we've been using for decades and decades aren't just perhaps cruel and unusual punishment, but they're actually bad science. And so in order to get an accurate understanding, if you're trying to understand the primate brain, and I think it's important to emphasize at the same time how much we've learned about how our own brain works, and how so many of the most effective treatments we have right now have grown up with primate research for diseases like Parkinson's, for instance. At the same time, I think we now know enough to know that the way we used to treat primates, and the way I think we too often still treat primates in labs is not just cruel and unusual, but actually very bad science.
Okay, thanks so much, guys. Just before we go, a thought from our blog on last week's programme. English Bloke posted,
you reported last week that a gene for optimism has been discovered. Might there be a gene for predisposing barriers to supernatural explanations, religion, astrology? A question I would like to have put to John Polkinghorne is, does he think there could be a scientific explanation for his religious persuasions?
We're looking forward to your thoughts on this week's programme on the blog. Find it at guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. You can also find details of our two new Twitter feeds for the programme and for updates of our science news as we publish it. Find the links on our page. Again, that's guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. Thanks for coming in, Jonah. A final question for you. Other than coming into The Guardian today, what's the worst decision you've made in your life?
Oh, God, the worst decision. I would say when I was 18, I decided to buy a motorcycle because I thought it looked very, very cool. It turned out I was driving this motorcycle home from the shop when I crashed it into a light pole. So I would say that was the worst $3,000 I've ever spent, and just about one of the worst decisions I ever spent. Don't buy a vehicle because you imagine yourself looking very cool in a leather jacket.
Not bad going, though.
No, so far so good. I'm sure I'll make many worse decisions.
Thanks again, Jaina, and thanks too to James Randerson and Nature's Jeff Brumfield for making it here after a hard night's karaoke. We'll be back next week when the author Michael Brooks joins us to run through 13 things that don't make sense. Advance warning, homeopathy is one of them. Until next week, I'm Ian Sample. The programme was produced by Scott Corley. Thanks for listening.